KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
Well, there's a lot up, and I'll try to go through it in a sequence here. First, just to characterize what's going on at the state and county level, we're definitely in the post-surge stage of this first wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Although, as you look at the wave, there was a very fast upslope, but the downslope is very gradual, and that's kind of what we expect. It takes a lot longer to recover from this infection than it takes to get it or to spread it in the first place. As most people know, we have had no new cases of COVID-19 diagnosed in Jefferson County since April 9th, and so that's 25 days in counting, and that's very good news. Along with this, we've seen a dramatic drop-off, really an abrupt end of the flu season, and a very sharp drop-off of flu-like illness. And we attribute this to all the social distancing and increased hand-washing and all the things that people are doing to protect themselves from coronavirus also protects you from the common cold and flu. And so we've seen a real drop off in respiratory illness, and that's a very good thing because it makes it easier for us to detect coronavirus when it occurs. That the symptoms of the two are indistinguishable from one another. And that was actually a question from the KPTZ listeners when we did all these tests for coronavirus, why were so few of them, less than 4% of them positive? And the reason was we were testing people with respiratory illnesses, and most of them had something other than coronavirus. That's our current status, is we're seeing very low levels of activity. We're seeing improved access to testing. So just in this last week, we've started to move from where we had to be with testing. That is very resource constrained and only testing a very narrow group of individuals, to where we want to be, which is essentially testing everyone with symptoms of illness and not just the original criteria we were using, which was fever, cough, and shortness of breath, but we've expanded that list of symptoms as well. As we learn more about coronavirus, we learn it can present in a number of different ways. So also people with persistent sore throat or muscle aches, like you get when you're coming down with a viral infection, chills, or what we call rigors, which is shaking with chills, is a symptom. We're also looking for people who have fevers in this very peculiar symptom we're seeing with coronavirus, where you temporarily lose your sense of taste or smell or both. We're ramping up testing of those groups. And in outbreak situations, if we see clusters of infection, we'll be doing very intensive testing, essentially testing everyone in the organization. If we see a outbreak in a business or a long-term care facility or those situations, because something we're learning more and more is that this infection is spread not only when people have symptoms, but in the 2 days before they develop symptoms, or with the folks we call asymptomatic cases, they can develop it without having symptoms at all. And this may be as much as 50% of the transmission may be related to those two groups, asymptomatic and presymptomatic. And so that makes this an extremely challenging thing to try to control. The nationally, We're now over 1 million diagnosed cases. We think the true number is probably 10 times that much or more. And the death count is now over 60,000 nationally and growing on a daily basis. As anyone following the news also knows, we're a nation that's getting very tired of being in quarantine. So there's quarantine fatigue, and there are a number of states are loosening their restrictions or abandoning them altogether. And what I have a quote here, what one of the modeling groups characterized this as arbitrary loosening, unmoored from the evidence and conditions on the ground. And when you do that, you risk making all your sacrifice for nothing. Because if you stimulate a second wave from a position where you still have a lot of disease transmission going on, you're guaranteed to have a second wave that's much worse than your first. So that, unfortunately, is what we're bracing for, is that people who don't believe in science are going to have to discover the hard way that communicable diseases really don't care what your beliefs or political ideologies are. They operate in a different realm, and they only care if they're susceptible people that they can use as hosts. So fortunately, in this state, we've taken a very different direction. We were the first in the nation to really experience a significant outbreak. So we were the original epicenter from this. And as you look at the performance of Washington State compared to the rest of the country, we are doing better than any other state relative to our starting point. And among other things, it's because we have a governor and elected officials and a public health community that believes in science and is committed to making decisions based on science and evidence. And I think this is reflected in the governor's latest plan and what we'll spend most of this time going over today. And that is, as we move from this lockdown, shelter at home, stay home, stay healthy campaign into a phased reopening, we're proposing to do that, and how the governor's authority is being used to kind of take the state step by step through that process, and how that plan also allows individual counties that meet certain conditions to seek variances from that plan. So first of all, let me go over what is going to change effective tomorrow. So this new phase one plan takes effect tomorrow. And it continues for people in high-risk populations. So those, we're now staying over age 65 rather than 60. The data really suggests that the risk starts to jump up significantly at age 65. So over age 65, or people of any age with chronic medical conditions, especially heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, chronic lung disease, are significant risk factors. They're still under the stay home, stay healthy. They're still at risk of very serious complications if their movement is unrestricted in public. In the recreational area, there's some opening. So hunting, fishing, golf, boating, hiking, all while maintaining appropriate physical distancing. That is 6 feet apart, and if you can't maintain that distance for brief periods, masking is recommended. Those things will now be open effective tomorrow. Gatherings are still prohibited. There is an exception for drive-in spiritual services where it's a household, there's not mixing of households within vehicles. Travel is still restricted to essential travel only. And then some businesses and employers are opening up. So essential businesses continue to stay open. Construction that meets certain criteria that's actually already been opened up. Landscaping, automobile sales, retail with curbside pickup is continuing. Car washes are opening up. Pet walking is now allowed. And within this plan is a process to allow variances for 10 counties in Washington state that are under 50,000 people in population and have very low evidence of a coronavirus activity, have not had cases in 3 weeks or longer. And I think, as most people know, Jefferson County is one of these 10 counties. So there's a very specific variance process that I'll go over in a moment. And what it allows the county to do, if a variance is granted, is to expand the number of outdoor activities that are allowed, so that some degree of camping and outdoor activity that involves fewer than five people from outside your household. So getting together with small groups of friends is allowed. Gatherings, again, are no more than five people outside your household per week is the standard. Limited non-essential travel within proximity of your home is allowed. That's not precisely defined what the proximity of your home is. Additional manufacturing is opened. New construction is permitted. In-home domestic services like house cleaning and nannies. Retail in-store purchases are allowed. Real estate is expanded. Professional services and office-based businesses are allowed, although telework is still strongly encouraged. And then hair and nail salons, barbers could be opened under phase two, house cleaning, and then restaurants that are able to have table capacity 50% of their usual capacity, and with table sizes no larger than five. So that's the list of possibilities under phase two. And what a county's the variance process allows the county to either seek all of those variances or any subset of them. So it's a menu. It's not an all or nothing kind of choice. And the process for this starts with the local health officer. And so the local health officer makes a request, or actually a recommendation, to the Board of Health to do one of three things. And the first is to request no variance whatsoever, to make the determination that it's unsafe to do any of these additional activities, in the sense that it would cause a dangerous increase in new cases that the local system would be unable to handle. So that would be one option. Option number two is to request all of the phase two activities to be implemented. And then option three would be some subset of those. So the health officer makes that recommendation to the Board of Health. The Board of Health deliberates it and takes a vote. and the proposal only moves forward if at least a majority of the Board of Health votes in favor. And for those members of the public listening who may not be familiar with the Board of Health, the Board of Health is a 7-member board. It's composed of the 3 county commissioners, and then in addition to the 3 county commissioners are 4 appointed members. One is a current city council member. Another is a current hospital board of commissioner member, and then there are 2 citizens at large. So it's a 7-member board. After the Board of Health takes a vote, it's also required that the local hospital weigh in and makes a certification that they have adequate bed capacity to deal with the surge of COVID-19 cases and also have adequate personal protective equipment to deal with that surge. And adequate is defined as a minimum 7-day supply. And then the final step is that the final local step is then that the variance request would go to the Board of County Commissioners. And they would take an up or down vote. The commissioners are not allowed to modify the subset of services that the Board of Health adopts, but they can either approve or disapprove of the decision that the Board of Health has made. And then it goes on to the State Department of Health for review and approval or disapproval. And along with that submission of a variance, there's information that we submit that we have to certify that we have adequate capacity to do the testing that would be necessary. There's just some new testing standards that came out this week about what would be adequate. And for Jefferson County, it would be the ability to do about 60 tests a day it fits with this new national testing formula. We report on the number of tests we've done in the last 3 weeks. We would need to discuss and certify that we have adequate plans to do the case investigation and contact tracing that would be necessary. We have to specify how many investigators we have and what our plans are along those lines. And then we also have to specify what our plans are for isolation and quarantine. Providing isolation to populations that don't have homes and quarantine for those who've been exposed who likewise don't have homes. And also isolation and quarantine for people who may have homes but for some reason may be unable to stay in those homes because a vulnerable person is those homes. And then we need to submit a plan for case management for isolation and quarantine. And what that means is people who are isolated are people who have active infections and they have active medical needs. So they have to be checked often on a daily basis to make sure they're okay medically, their condition is not worsening, if they've developed any complications, those need to be dealt with. And then for quarantine, it's somewhat different. People are not ill when they're in quarantine, but they're being monitored closely. So checking in on a daily basis and making sure that they haven't developed symptoms, making sure that their needs are being met. That if they need food or errands or some kind of support service, that we make sure to provide that. And if and when they do develop symptoms, then we have them very rapidly tested, and they are then in isolation. And if there's been any additional contacts, such as household contacts, then they would be in quarantine. And then the final thing we need to certify to the state is that we have an outbreak plan. So we have a plan that in a worst-case scenario, and despite our best efforts, we get an outbreak in a long-term care facility or some other congregate setting, we have a plan to deal with that, because those are some of the most challenging things that go on with coronavirus. So as you see, this is not a simple process, but it's a thorough one, and it's very much evidence-based. And the reason for all of this, and I completely support this concept, is that we paid a huge price to get as far as we are, and we don't want to lose ground. We want to build on this success. We want to move forward. And we want to learn what we need to learn to control the transmission of this infection until we get a vaccine. And here in Jefferson County, we've really appreciated this lull in the storm. The last 25 days without cases has allowed us to focus on essentially everything on this list, you know, building up our case management capabilities and working with the hospital on case management for isolated patients and support for people in quarantine. So all these different things, because we've recognized for a long time that reopening was going to depend on having this very robust capacity to identify cases, respond that same day. You know, our goal is to complete case investigations, identify all contacts, and get them into quarantine on the day we learn about the test result. And the timing, another bit of good news in this, that, you know, in our first wave of this, we were waiting sometimes as long the longest was 14 days we waited for one lab test result. And many of them, the average was more like 5 to 8 days. So we had these very long time lags. Now, we expect to have that down to a matter of hours in some cases. Our routine tests, we should get 24-hour turnaround from the University of Washington. And now that Jefferson Healthcare has the capability of doing the test in their own lab, we could conceivably get test results in a matter of a few hours. So that's really the kind of speed and capability we need to react to this. And we have, you know, our staffing for case investigators is sort of a 24/7 system. You know, during the first wave, we worked through the weekends, and we will staff to do that in this thing. We can't afford to miss a single day when it's trying to identify cases and get them isolated or quarantined. Because that's old school public health. That's how you control infections, as you find that people are infected and you keep them from passing that infection on to someone else. And the better you do that, the sooner the infection goes away. So I'm sure there's a lot of questions. I'll just have more information on this, but I'm how about if I just open it to questions now, and I can add stuff, if there's adequate time.
Thank you, Dr. Locke. I have one question, and I know this is going to be an inexact answer, but what kind of time frame are you looking at for us to come up together with a robust variant plan? Are we talking a matter of days, hours, weeks?
It's certainly in the days to weeks range. I know we have a meeting scheduled on Thursday of this week to bring together the county commissioners and the city council. I think the key thing at this point is getting a lot of input from all the elected officials, the hospital commissioners, the Board of Health. I'm receiving a lot of very valuable input from the public. I've suddenly become a very popular person for people to comment on variance proposals, and I appreciate it. It's very well thought out. I very much realized the stakes and how important this is for people's lives. I don't think that the variance application itself is pretty straightforward. So once we make the decision of what we think is safe and what we think may be unsafe on this list, the actual process of applying for the variance is straightforward. I mean, we could complete the application in a day or two. We do have to go through the process of convening the Board of Health, which we can do on 24 hours public notice. And under the current situations, we would do it in the same format. We would do it virtually, which actually makes it even easier to do it on short notice. And so we have to go through those steps of Board of Health and Board of Commissioners. The Department of Health has assured us that they would review anything we submitted very expeditiously. So I think the turnaround time there is short. But realistically, to do this right, we probably are talking about several weeks. And if it's shorter than that, that's great.
Well, can I say, and Greg kind of implied in your question, is that we are going to apply for a variance. And I actually haven't heard the first step as outlined in the governor's plan, which is, Dr. Locke, whether you will recommend that we do that or not. So. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that, without having, we haven't gone into this with full detail, but just, eyeballing phase two list, there probably are some things on that list that are safe to do, given our current situation. We've actually done a lot of work in this county on the case management, contact tracing, the hospital side of this. We have been working full time the last 2.5 months, really, on this project. So it's not like we're starting that from scratch. And those are the key elements of this. It's what we have to look really carefully at is how we would do some of these phase two things locally and what the unintended impacts would be. Because that's the most difficult and the most worrisome thing. And the most specific unintended impact I'm concerned about is that anything that would provide incentives for people to violate the essential travel ban. So to the extent that we do things that encourage people to come from the I-5 counties to Jefferson County, we could very quickly reverse our gains. So that would be very unwise, and that's a criteria we have to evaluate every proposal we have. But if we can convince ourselves that there are certain things on that list that would not do that, then they're candidates for it. I'm sorry, Mr. Marley.
Yeah, so the other thing that occurs to me is the other piece beyond the question of inviting travel from the I-5 corridor that would be ill-advised is we've seen real diversity in the kinds of protocols that have been put in place in businesses. So, for example, there are some shining stars, like as noted in public comment today, the Kimmicum Corner Farm Stand, the food co-op in Port Townsend, taking very careful measures. Some of the other grocery outlets, you don't see the same degree of adherence to those kinds of precautions. And so when you look business by business type, I think the real work and the time-consuming part of this is what are the business practices that need to be put in place for them to be able to reopen safely? Do they have the supplies they need? Have they trained their staff to do that? do they have to how to operate in this new normal? Do they have education signage available not only for their staff but for the public that would be coming? So I think there's a lot of logistics side to this that needs to be looked at very carefully before we press a green light for a particular sector to open up. And that's going to be take work, planning, and some time.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. And given that we would, in effect, be state leaders in that respect, and that we're the first to venture into phase two, it makes it all the more important. Fortunately, some of that work has already been done. But were we to venture into those areas, it would not throw the door open for all businesses in that category. The only ones that would be eligible for opening would be ones that met all of the criteria specific for their particular line of business. And in some cases, it's not a simple matter. As Mr. Morley suggested, it requires equipment that people may not have. It requires training and skills and re-engineering their work process in a way that may seem very foreign to them. But you know, we have to do it sometime. And starting this month, starting down that road, I think is a positive thing, because we know we will eventually reopen in this state. And if people are motivated to seriously look at what they're doing, what it will take to do that safely, you know, that I see that as a healthy thing to do.
Dr. Locke, is there guidance for these businesses being developed? For example, I've heard of beauty salons separating their chairs so many feet apart. How do they know that's enough? How do they know they don't need more of a barrier? How do they know whether low driving is okay? You know, there's a whole lot of little detail that needs to be considered to see if people are meeting these kind of practices, and how is that work going to be done? I can see some of it being done by the industry, but who tracks that? Who signs off on that? How do we communicate that this restaurant's open, but these restaurants aren't?
All right. Well, I can tell you the way I would like to do it, and that is that we would have evidence-based practice. We would have had controlled studies where they try different configurations and see which ones work and which ones don't work. You know, that's the science way of doing it, and unfortunately, we're not going to have that for the most part because we're in the early stages of this pandemic. I heard an analysis this weekend that said if this was a baseball game, you know, we're in the second inning of it. And I'm not even sure of that. I think we might be in the bottom of the first on this. And so some of those things like salons, we may simply not know what is safe. And until we learn what is safe, we may not be able to do it. There are states experimenting with this. I mean, there's no controlled experiments I know going on, but there are a lot of uncontrolled experiments. And we will probably find out if the things that they're doing in, you know, Texas and Georgia and some of the states where they just kind of thrown things wide open to see whether they work or not. You know, I don't recommend that we experiment on people's lives, you know, that we do those kind of uncontrolled experiments here in Jefferson County. Of the things on the list, unfortunately, things like hair and nail salons and barbers, those are the ones that not only do we know the least about, But they also have potential of drawing people from other areas. You know, if we are, if Jefferson County has the only salons that are open, you know, in Western Washington, that's not a good distinction. That's not what we want to be providing. Now there may be ways to work around that, where you can only schedule appointments with people, you know, who are county residents or things like that. But we have to look at all of those details. And not only the obvious infection control practices, but I'm suspecting the hardest thing to look at is the unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. You have to step back and say, okay, you know what your intended consequences are, but what are the things that might happen just by changing the incentives that are going on?
Mm-hmm. Can I jump in with a couple of questions and comments? One, it sounds, Dr. Luck, like you have received more detailed information from the governor's office on phase two and the variants than we have. If that's something you could share with us, I'd love to see that. Researching and looking for it, so I imagine you've gotten more details.
Yeah, it just came out this morning, actually, the final documents. I'll send those along.
Okay, yeah, I look forward to seeing that. And I do want to definitely talk about the process and how we're going to move forward, because we could get into every detail and question and then do it all over again with the Board of Health. So I'm aware that we don't necessarily need to do that. But I do want to call out a couple things I think are important. You know, I was bombarded all weekend with emails, calls, questions on this, and I was really surprised to hear a number of businesses, including some of our anchor businesses in town, saying they do not want to open, begging us not to reopen, that it puts an undue pressure on them to do so at a time when they don't feel it's safe, when they feel like they're going to be attracting a lot of people from outside of the area, and at a time that isn't safe for their employees. So I want to be sure that we include the business community in this conversation, because I think those are important perspectives. Also, something that I know is going to be really important to me as we consider this is, and this is giving you some warning, Dr. Lack, but I'll need your help with this, is understanding our authorities. So if we are to move forward, you know, for example, I would be uncomfortable, and I think we've heard pretty loud and clear from the public about discomfort of inviting overnight accommodation, especially with at least four of our state parks are opening tomorrow. If, you know, in space two, that opens up to camping with five people or fewer, could we say as a county plan that we want to prohibit camping here, you know, as a form of out-of-town overnight accommodation? Can we require or mandate in some way the wearing of masks in, you know, say, retail establishments? Are there things that we can limit to county residents? These are the kind of authorities I'd like us to understand and consider applying to a variance plan.
And when I would respond to all of those things you mentioned and more, the answer is yes. With my understanding of this, we could modify the phase two plans in any way we saw fit. And right now, the health officer and or the Board of Health has the authority to do almost everything the governor's doing. And so to mandate masks, to do even more restrictive closures in Jefferson County. We asked the governor to do it because we wanted to assure this kind of consistent statewide response. And as we deviate from that original plan and do individual rural variants, we have to be really conscious of the, you know, the potential cost. Mr. Marley.
Yeah, it does strike me that there's some irony here that, as you've commented before, the restrictions that we've had so up till now have been a very blunt instrument. As we consider opening up and loosening, ironically, that may require more restrictions on individual things like masks in stores as we're opening up to make it safe to do so. And so there may be some cross streams here of, as a society and as an economy beginning to open up more, but at the same time needing to increase some of the protections that are there to allow that to happen.
Dr. Locke, I also have a question about some of the numbers we hear. Five seats at a table in a restaurant, gathered of 10 or 50. How do these numbers come about, and what are they based on, and can we vary those?
They're somewhat arbitrary, and they're just because really it's a gradient. You know, it's that the difference between five and six is very tiny. So it's with each new non-household member you add to your group, the risk of exposure increases. And so it's an arbitrary process of drawing a line somewhere. And that I would say, yes, we could draw the line at a different place, but no higher than the state line. So five would be the maximum for phase two, but we could, in Jefferson County, say three or two or one. So anything less than that could be our standard. Or not.
Can we define proximity or ask the governor for more clarification on that? I think it's pretty clear that, you know, the biggest challenge in this is out-of-county travelers and you know, kind of looking at the lowest common denominator of the state. And I know with our little business down in Discovery Bay, it's a tourist-based business. We won't be opening until Washington is open. But I'm curious if in preparation for this, we can get a little more clarification on what, you know, proximity means by the governor.
Yeah, I think we really need that. I think all the waiver counties, if I could use that term, need this. I know there's a statewide meeting scheduled this afternoon of the waiver counties that we're having a virtual meeting like this that hopefully we'll start to get into those questions, because I think we need to seriously ask the state and the state patrol what they're going to be able to do to enforce the travel bans. You know, right now it's kind of an advisory more than anything else. But as counties start moving into phase two, and it, you know, does serve there is a real benefit to the state to kind of try some of these things out on a small scale before they try them out on a larger scale. But we really need help from the state in terms of the trying to prevent the thing that we're most concerned about, and that is, you know, this self-fulfilling prophecy of encouraging people to come to the area and unintentionally bringing their higher prevalence of infection with them.
And in that, Dr. Locke and commissioners, I've shared with you over the weekend an analysis of the 10 counties, and really Jefferson County is right in the crosshairs of that issue in a way that no other county is. We are the closest to a metropolitan area of 4 million people. We have ocean, mountains, and we are a tourism mecca in a way that the other communities on the list are not. And so that issue is particularly salient for Jefferson County in contrast to all other 9 counties.
Well, and if I can believe what I heard Friday afternoon from reliable sources that Grays Harbor County, the only other Western Washington county, right away came out saying they did not plan to pursue a variance, and I realize that might change in their process. and Kittitas County came right out and said they were going to. So there were some strong indications early on, and I appreciate us being really deliberate and weighing options very carefully before making a strong position one way or the other. But, you know, if we are to proceed, it will make us the Western Washington guinea pig, which, you know, I've had a few people say it's kind of unfair of the governor to put this on all of us, and yet I appreciate that he is trying to allow counties that aren't urban counties the flexibility to respond in the way they see best. So it's a really a double-edged sword. Can we talk about next steps?
Let's talk about next steps. I do want to make sure we leave time for Willie and the EOC. Maybe can we take a quick update from the EOC? And, you know, I might have a couple questions in regards to this variance process for our Department of Emergency Management, too. So let's if you can hold on, Dr. Locke, let's pass it off to Willie for a quick update.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Much appreciated. Most of our core work continues. Just now with the additional reopening phases and the potential of variance application in mind. Obviously, PPE has been an ongoing priority for us, and it becomes even more urgent with the fact that we may be looking at starting to reopen certain segments of the economy and of social life very shortly. Masks have actually been, we're in decent stock of those N95s, as well as the cloth community-made masks for private citizens. We're starting to see, you know, more gloves and sanitizers becoming more available, things like that. We're still struggling with gowns, although we saw a pretty decent shipment of those last week, but those are still being fairly carefully rationing. And then, of course, test kits, transports, all that kind of fun stuff. There was some confusion at the state level over specifically the ordering and acquisition process, whether or not that goes through emergency management, through local health jurisdictions, all that kind of fun stuff. But we've got that squared away and have been really working to ensure the hospital has adequate testing, adequate transport, all that kind of stuff. Within the reopening and the potential variance application, there were a few things Dr. Locke had talked about we've been working on and we're continuing to work on, specifically around case management. We have some folks volunteered to lead a program to provide support to folks in isolation and quarantine, both in terms of things like potential food delivery, as well as ongoing contact and mental health support. You know, being in isolation and alone can be a pretty taxing time in one's life, so we want to make sure we're supporting those folks. I'm also working with OLECAP to help enable them to open up a second isolation and quarantine facility for those who can't do so on their own. So we're actually working to open that earlier this week, providing them with some cots and blankets via the Red Cross. I'm making some modifications to a facility to expand their capacity there. So I'm just, again, working on things that we've been working on, but now have a little bit more clarity with the governor's additional reopening phases and his expectations for what's going to make a success as we begin to open there. Finally, last but not least, our planning team has been assembling some metrics that we feel will be useful for the conversation around reopening. Obviously, Dr. Locke and the hospital have a pretty good grasp on our medical capacity and our testing and tracing capacity. But we hope to add some more to the conversation and are assembling things around, you know, civil, social, economic impacts of the closure and the reopening. So they're assembling that, and we'll have that available for the policymakers by the end of the week. Last but not least, we're also taking this little bit of a pause, and as we've been making good progress in certain areas and want to prepare for the reopening and prepare for the next surge, we're actually starting our after-action review process of this kind of first leg of the response. So typically at the end of an emergency, you all get together and talk about what went right, what went wrong, and how you're going to improve in the future. Although, like Dr. Locke said, we're in the bottom of the first for this pandemic as a whole, we do have a break between innings, so to speak. And so we're using that break to actually review our response thus far and make some recommendations for, again, the reopening, how we're going to coordinate and work together there, how we're going to work together and coordinate and respond to potential additional waves. So the planning section and I are meeting together a little bit later this afternoon, and we'll be facilitating some feedback from key stakeholders and response partners over the next week or two to kind of assemble, an after-action improvement report just based on that first inning of this response. So we'll be getting some feedback, obviously, from all of you, and look forward to sharing those reports and that recommendation moving forward. That's in a report from the EOC.
Great. Thank you, Willie. And my question, mostly for you and a little bit for Dr. Locke, is, you know, as we work on these potential variance plans, a lot of the smaller the business is, it seems the more difficult it is to source some of these things like PPE and hand sanitizer and everything. And do you think the Department of Emergency Management will have the capacity to, put together kits for small businesses or assist in sourcing those materials as these plans come to fruition?
Yeah, and that's something our logistics section is actually, we started talking about that last week, and they're actually putting together a plan to identify at the very least how they can facilitate the acquisition of those materials. Because obviously, we can't necessarily use taxpayer money to support private businesses, but we can at least facilitate and help identify where they can get those materials. But they have been in relatively short supply. Obviously, our primary focus is the Department of Health has put together prioritization tiers for which we actually do supply PPE to, obviously like the hospital, long-term care facilities, things like that. But as PPE becomes more and more available, we go from prioritization tier 1 to tier 2, 3, et cetera. And then part of our overall reopening plan will indeed be facilitating helping some of these businesses get their hands on the supplies to help protect their workers. And I will say, one way that we've already been doing that for a while is our community mask program. We have hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of cloth, handmade, homemade sewed masks that have been donated and then distributed to help protect the community, help protect those essential workers who are still working. So we'll be identifying other ways to help support protection of the community here moving forward. And that will definitely be a part of our reopening plan.
Thank you. Any other questions for Willie? All right. Well, thank you very much, Willie and Kate. I forgot what where you wanted to go.
Just kind of next steps. And I'm aware of really wanting to be mindful that the Board of Health has a really key role in this decision. And so wanting to be clear about how we're planning to pull them in. So if we could outline some of the plans we've made to date for the public, benefit of the public, and to get the Board of Health notified that we're moving ahead. So maybe, Dr. Locke, is that something you can walk us through?
Yes. I think the timeline I'm looking on is this is really the week to gather information, from the public, from the affected businesses, from all the stakeholders. I want to be meeting with the hospital. We're having this special meeting I mentioned on Thursday with the commissioners and the city council. And I think it's our opportunity to kind of go through this list in detail and ask ourselves these difficult questions as to the go no go decision. If there's not a single thing on this list that we think we can do safely, then the decision would be to go for no variance. I'm actually not even sure if that takes a Board of Health meeting. It probably stops there. If the health officer says no variance, it stops there under the process. If there's at least one thing on the list, if we can, for instance, convince ourselves that new home construction would not have an adverse effect, then the decision becomes more complicated. Then it becomes a menu where we have to ask ourselves, is there anything else on the list? And I would like to, if I'm to start the process, I would like to hear what everyone else says. I can look at this from a very technical aspect of transmission potentiation risk, but that's not the only valid perspective. Everything else should be weighed in as well. And then I'm hoping at least by the end of this week or the early part of next week, we'll have some sense of consensus as to whether You know, if there's broad consensus that at least one thing on the list is worth considering, then we should go ahead with scheduling the Board of Health. And the Board of Health is really going to be the forum to look at a detailed plan for, you know, what's okay, what's not okay, and if something's okay, what are the restrictions, including additional restrictions that are not specified by the governor. So that could turn into a pretty complex process. Mm-hmm. Mr. Morley.
Yeah, one of the things that I think you mentioned, Dr. Locke, the concept of consensus and recognizing the twin urgent concerns for people of, number one, protecting public health, but also, number two, trying to mitigate the financial impact this is having on the viability of our local businesses and on people's individual finances who are laid off. Those are very core concerns for this community. And so I think you're right of having some beginning process, and today is a first step in that direction of having some public dialogue of really getting those twin concerns on the table and talking about how we balance those and how, what are the things, seeing if we can develop some sense of community cohesion and general consensus on what are the considerations that you, the Board of Health, and ultimately the Board of County Commissioners will need to be taking into account so that people understand what's being weighed, what's the process that we're going to go through to get there. And you've mentioned what so far has just been an idea of trying to start that process by holding a special meeting of the City Council and the Board of County Commissioners later this week, on potentially on Thursday. But this is the first time that there's really an opportunity for the county commissioners to hear that idea, to discuss it. I think if I'm interpreting some of the questions, Kate, that you asked, is maybe that whether the full Board of Health should be included in that meeting.
Yeah.
And who else should be there? You know, whether representatives from the business community should be there. The chamber, the EDC, Main Street, that kind of thing. So I just want to sort of open that up. That doesn't really hem in what you do, Dr. Locke, and your recommendations, but I think just trying to for support your efforts, if we can get some broader community alignment and consensus on the approach that's being taken here, I think there'll be greater adherence and cohesion in its implementation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know what a hot issue this is across the country, and I think we can expect that I'm already seeing a similar fervor around the decision. And as Commissioner Sullivan said, suddenly everybody's a public health expert. I would prefer that, because the Board of Health has a critical role in this process, that they are included in all information and deliberation, including the special meeting on Thursday evening. Is there any reason not to include them?
I can't think of it. I don't think that meeting would count, or we could use it as the meeting for the waiver process. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have to have a separate announced meeting where we have to have the details pretty much worked out before the meeting, and the board's function would be to consider those carefully, modify them as they see fit, and then be prepared to act on them or decline to act on them. But
I see
as a preview, it would be great for them to be involved.
I see this first meeting as an opportunity to really set the table of what kind of information needs to be gathered that the Board of Health is going to need, that you're going to need, Dr. Locke, on a business sector by business sector basis, so that then DEM and others can move forward in collecting that information to bring back to you and the Board of Health to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
kind of
a scoping meeting.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great to have the Board of Health. We'll have a three-way joint meeting. Might be a first.
Mm-hmm. Somebody from the hospital would be included as well to weigh in on those important points. Not necessarily declaring anything one way or another, but giving us the right criteria to be considering.
Yep, they've been invited.
Great. And then we should think about how we want the business community represented. So I think that's important as well. And, you know, one question I do have, Dr. Locke, part of the trouble with this, and I'm hearing from business owners, and Commissioner Brotherton has said it himself as a business owner, one of the hardest things to consider is openings, closings, openings, closings. I worry a little bit that if we increase the amount of testing that we're doing, we might see an uptick in positive cases, regardless if we open or not. And with that happening at the same time, we do a potential opening. What is our threshold for acceptance going to be if we start seeing cases rise? And then we put businesses in the position of closing again, which is exactly what they're saying they want least of all. So that's a real risk, too, that we have to be prepared to address.
Yeah, I hope to learn more about that at the meeting this afternoon with the state, is how far they've thought along those lines. Although, actually, we do have, in the public health literature, there's been a lot of work on modeling and metrics. That is to say, the levels you need to maintain in order to prevent outbreaks. And it's generally, if you have a full testing program, if you are doing an adequate amount of tests, the projections now is less, if you can keep less than 2% of them positive. So if 98% of your tests come back negative, then you're in the right place. You know, you're doing enough testing and you're controlling disease transmission. So that's the kind of thing we're shooting for.
We're not at that rate right now, though. We're still over 3%, right?
Well, it depends on the time period. If you average it over the last 2 months, we're not. But, over the last 3.5 weeks, we're actually at 0%.
Any other comments? This is the first of many. I think the one firm outcome of right now is that we want to make sure that we try to convene the Board of Health at this Thursday meeting as well. Any other action items that we're coming out of right now? Go ahead, Philip.
Well, I think there was also discussion of trying to include some representatives from the business community. I think it would be good for you commissioners to discuss that. And then secondly, since this is your one opportunity to talk it through as a group, over the weekend, I did forward to all of you a draft agenda, and if you have comments or refinements on that, that would be good input to bring into the DEM policy management group discussion later.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. And thank you for listening.